I think it really changed her as a person, and you know, that ultimately put her in a different, more combative, you know, defensive kind of posture toward the press.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pekes. And on this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, Elise Stefanik's origin story and the truth. Well, Northern New York Congresswoman Elise Stefanik is highly favored to win re-election in the 21st District. That is, if she isn't picked by close ally Donald Trump to join the former president's ticket in November's election. Stefanik's meteoric rise in Republican politics is putting new attention on the Harvard-educated congresswoman's upbringing. And the Daily Beast reports Stefanik's version of events isn't totally truthful. Reporter Jake LaHut, who might be familiar to listeners in the Northeast from stints at the Daily Gazette and the Times Union, wrote the story and joins me now. Thank you for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me, Ian.
So to begin with, what is the story that Congresswoman Stefanik has told about her roots in Northern New York pre-joining the Congress?
So I guess as far back as we could get in interviews here, and this was a lot of document reporting from my colleague, Will Bretterman, who's our senior researcher at the Daily Beast. It's generally, if she's given an interview for some of the early profiles or, you know, kind of remarks she would make about her background later on, that she was a first generation college student and was the daughter of, you know, a humble small business owner who sold plywood, and she worked her way up, and, you know, basically that she had this kind of, you know, everyday middle class upbringing. And that's kind of been, you know, part of the appeal for her, as especially when you look at how she's tacked her career since Trump's rise to power in 2016, being a kind of anti-establishment, you know, anti-intellectual, that plays very well if you're trying to win a GOP primary these days. And often the, you know, Harvard University and Albany Academy for Girls bits of her biography are played down. I mean, most recently, she's really gone to war with Harvard over the ouster of their president. But the things that, you know, she always emphasizes kind of gloss over a couple key breaks that she's gotten along the way.
So what was the family business?
I think anyone who works in construction contracting can attest to the fact that plywood is actually a sneakily very profitable business, especially if you're at the wholesale level. So the premium plywood products company that her dad was running, obviously this, you know, it's not publicly listed, it's a private company. So, you know, we don't have data on its revenue year to year or anything, but we can tell from some other transactions and outlays that it's been reasonably flush with cash. The best example, I think, would be this 1991 Small Business Administration loan they got. So in you know, 1991 dollars, that's $335,000. But to just put it in perspective for today with inflation, that would be like closer to $1 million at $755,000. Yeah, that's like 10 times the median income in New York State last year. The other thing we found, Will found a tax lien that was back in 97 that came out to like $21,000. So that's about like $40,000 in today's dollars. And Elise Stefanik's father was able to pay that off within a month. The other thing to keep in mind about, you know, a school like Albany Academy for Girls at the time is that, you know, these are very, very small graduating classes, often in the, you know, the 30 to 40-ish student range. And, you know, only a few students would get financial aid or anything approaching a full ride there. And then the business has, you know, she's worked for it briefly. It helped boost her credentials when she moved up to the family lake house on Lake Champlain and began running as a candidate in the 21st district. This is back when it was held by Democrat Bill Owens. And they gave her a North Country title in the business that she hadn't had before, because she'd been working in D.C. She was doing quite well. Went straight into the Bush administration coming out of college and had, you know, been making great contacts there. But then the plywood business kind of gave her first, you know, hook into saying that she had some sort of claim to the North Country, even though, you know, she was growing up in the Albany suburbs. And was coming from a very different universe than, you know, the kind of hard scrabble tale she'd been telling.
So for candidates who have challenged her in the years since, being labeled a carpetbagger, you know, that's a common criticism from the Stefanik campaign. What's the truth of that Essex County vacation property that gave her a claim to run in the district in that first election?
Yeah, so this is pretty key. And, you know, I mean, the carpetbagging debate comes up in all sorts of races, and it can become like the first fight that comes up. So this is on a little peninsula on Lake Champlain. They have had it from, it looks like 2012. And, you know, we're talking about, like, at the time, an initial home sale of around like $500,000. So it's definitely quite a nice property. And then she eventually will list herself as being from Saratoga. And I believe it was she and her husband moved to Schuylerville later in the district. But the property also ended up racking up some unpaid tax bills, which we get into in the story. And then, you know, later on, so she ends up getting this townhouse in Washington, D.C. that her parents bought for her when she was like 26 years old. And the family eventually gets into these property businesses that these all kind of become a part of. So, you know, I guess part of a way to think about the Stefanik, and, you know, you can call it a family fortune. We're not talking about billionaires here, obviously. But in terms of just kind of understanding the amount of privilege and, you know, kind of cash available, having some of these high value properties like the lake house and then eventually the one in DC, you know, that allows you to borrow against them. And they're quite nice assets to have rather than not in this world, you know.
And there was also a question raised in the piece about others who had invested in these properties. I think at one point Stefanik said, well, she had a minority stake in what was an investment property.
Yeah. And her brother also ended up getting a horse training business. And it's hard to quite parse out who has stakes of what. But it does seem that, you know, Stefanik has acknowledged, this is in a company called EMS DC Properties. She does have some sort of stake in that. And there's another family real estate business called SKMM Properties, which has her parents and her brother's initials in it. It appears she doesn't have a stake in that one. But yeah, it's hard to parse some of that stuff out.
Now, what did Stefanik's campaign say to you and the Daily Beast when presented with these questions or potential inconsistencies?
Well, I guess in kind of true to form, they attacked the media and the reporting to begin with. And they insisted that we had gotten a pitch on this story, which is not true. We didn't have any third party or, you know, rival Republicans or Democrats try to float us some oppo on this. And then they repeated a lot of the same kind of language that she's been using over these years, talking about how she grew up in a hardworking small business family and that her, you know, parents built it from scratch. And yeah, so I'm not sure if there was certainly no acknowledgement of any kind of, you know, benefits or privilege she may have gotten over the years. There was no nuanced attempt at saying, you know, well, hey, maybe, you know, I oversimplified when I was first running, or this is something I've kind of come to, you know, grapple with more as I've gotten older. None of that. I do think an interesting thing about her upbringing, for anyone who knows the scene at what we now call the Albany Academies of the boys and girls school together. And full disclosure, I graduated from there in 2013. But, you know, that is the kind of place where even if you are coming from a pretty wealthy family on paper, the kind of legacy old money names that dominate that place can very well, you know, easily make someone who is really coming from a quite wealthy background feel like they might be more middle class than they are. You know, you just take a swing by there and look at the parking lot, and it's more like a luxury car dealership than like a, you know, a starter car high school type setup. So, I kind of wish if they made her available for an interview or anything, we could have gotten into that. But I do think that that is a key part of her upbringing before she gets to Harvard that, you know, might, you know, start to make sense of some of this.
Yeah, you know, I want to talk to you for a second just about the journalism side of this, because Stefanik, you know, I've been here at the station and producing the Congressional Corner series and working in our newsroom for her entire run in Congress. And at the beginning, you know, she was kind of known as a moderate, a middle of the road. You know, she was in the Paul Ryan, Pawlenty aisle of the Republican Party. And there were times when she was accessible to questioning. I happened to be in Tupper Lake the other day covering the eclipse, and Stefanik was there, but I only found that out by happenstance. I mean, her office has long since stopped presenting her schedule in advance or making time for media availabilities. So don't you think that that will play in, assuming that she has a role to play in this election this year, whether that's running again for Congress as one of the top House Republicans or potentially as a vice presidential candidate, that at some point one would think she's going to have to take real questions again. And she hasn't really done that so much in the past number of years.
Yeah, I think her interview on Meet the Press back in January was a pretty big deal in that respect. Mm-hmm. I think especially if you look at the other candidates who are in the consideration for Trump's VP pick right now. And I mean, I've been reporting on this shortlist now for over a year, and she was one of the first five names we had on it, all women. Putting aside, you know, my journalistic desire for transparency and for all politicians to sort of, you know, be game for interviews or press gaggles, what have you, I do think that as a media strategy, what she's been doing is quite interesting. You know, so I mean, as you're aware, up until this point, the only places that might snag an interview with Stefanik, and I think especially post 2018, would be, you know, one of the North Country local TV affiliates, often something to do, you know, with a military based thing, or, you know, another kind of local project, easy optics, quick story, bankable, it can lead the hour, you know, you're in, you're out. And that's the kind of event that any smart member of Congress would be doing. I think what you'll see more of as the jockeying for the Veep stakes continues is her going in, you know, what people in Trump world would call hostile interview environments, where she's sort of, as you saw in the Meet the Press one, where the big, you know, line she had from that was that she would have done differently than former Vice President Mike Pence on January 6th, and she would have not certified the election and kicked it back to the states. And then, I mean, who knows what would have happened at that point.
Plus, she called the people who've been prosecuted for the riot the hostages. She said that twice.
Yes, and she was early on that train, and now that is kind of standard, that's sort of a standard Trump language in the rallies. So, you know, when you have people like J.D. Vance who are doing the same thing, he's doing more, you know, television sit-down interviews and mixing it up with reporters. You don't see as much of that from Tim Scott, but you know, when you kind of break the race up into lanes, I mean, Stefanik's lane here is that she would be one, you know, the most loyal of the group to President Trump, I think, you know, from her team's point of view. And she would sort of be there in a, I guess what you conventionally would call, you know, in horse race politics, an attack dog role. But I mean, there's nothing conventional about this scenario with Trump and the four indictments. So, you know, brass tacks, I mean, you're looking at what, like Trump being stuck in court 4 days a week right now. You know, he needs people to get up on TV and defend him and, you know, take care of some of the, in a way, having someone, you know, to be a bit of an enforcer when Trump might not want to, you know, hold a big press conference or do all the back and forth with the press himself, besides, you know, his usual routine at the rallies. So that's definitely something to keep an eye on. I think that the reticence really comes back from the Trump Ukraine hearings in 2019. I mean, it definitely seems like the 2018 midterms were a big deal where, there have been a ton of pieces written about this, of her kind of ideological transformation from championing some more bipartisan stuff and recruiting more women to run for office on the Republican side all the way over to, you know, going full MAGA. But I think that the incoming she got after coming out and defending Trump so forcefully in the 2019 impeachment over Ukraine, suddenly, you know, she's getting some just a crazy amount of angry calls to her office, and then also threats, you know, to her and her family. And I think that when she kind of went from being, you know, maybe if you paid really close attention to politics, you knew that she was kind of this up and coming, you know, younger Republican from upstate New York, to suddenly she's, at least, you know, for people who are maybe on the cable news circuit or what have you, she's closer to a household name for those folks. And the level of vitriol that came her way for defending Trump in that scenario, I think it really changed her as a person. And, you know, that ultimately put her in a different, more combative, you know, defensive kind of posture toward the press.
So just to wrap up, Jake, you know, as this Veep stakes plays out, and there's the high likelihood that Stefanik was going to play a key role in GOP politics, you know, for this year and for the foreseeable future in all likelihood, what questions do you still have about her rise to office that haven't been answered?
I think what would you do in certifying the election is the big one, and she's made her position clear on that. So I guess it wouldn't be that one. And for me, it would be something more along the lines of, especially when you talk about psychologically with Trump, to what extent has she kind of seen herself as an outsider over the years? I think that, you know, this kind of money tale is just a small part of a bigger complex that makes her very appealing to Trump. And also that, you know, a lot of people who have worked for her and, you know, still work for her are very well connected in Trump world. And of all the Veep stakes candidates, she might have the kind of you look at her former press secretary, Carolyn Leavitt, being the Trump campaign's new press secretary. You know, a longtime mentor of hers, Michael Caputo, who's been with Trump since 2016. There's this, you know, nexus of a pretty strong connection there. And I would just want to hear her thoughts on, you know, kind of how she thought of herself coming up in the Albany area, and then when she went on to Harvard, in the sense of, I almost see some, without being too reductive about it, I almost see some parallels between her father and Fred Trump as a figure for both herself and the former president, where, you know, in Trump's case, you have this very successful father figure, but he makes his money not in Manhattan and not in the kind of, you know, the big flashy projects that Trump, well, that Donald, I should say, strives for down the line. And instead, you have this kind of outside looking in dynamic from Queens, where Trump is always kind of pining to be in that Manhattan elite, but he's never quite there. And then when he is there, he's not respected. And then with Stefanik, I mean, you know, I know that some of her, you know, former classmates are a little reticent to talk about it, but from all accounts, she was quite well liked at Albany Academy for Girls, and she did well on the debate team. And she was known then as pretty conservative and being, you know, outspoken in class. But, you know, I do wonder, having been at the institution myself at Albany Academy, how much of that can make someone resent, you know, a sort of political elite. And then when you add, you know, a Harvard education on top of that, and you end up becoming a very prominent Republican, and, you know, former alumni distance themselves from you, and eventually she lost, you know, the position she had with the Kennedy School. I wonder how much of that can really turn you into, you know, a different kind of person, and how that informs the more populist brand of conservatism that she's embraced ever since then. So I guess that would be my one, but that's a good question. I mean, that's definitely something I think, you know, you always, especially if you're like a Capitol Hill reporter, you want to have that. If you never know, you can have it on hand.
Yeah,
but it's tough because there are so many high stakes ones with what being a vice president would do, or, you know, she could very well end up in a very prominent cabinet position too. And that's totally on the table.
Yeah. And she has said, you know, which oftentimes people don't say, but she said, I'm happy to serve in the second Trump administration if I have the chance. Yeah. It just makes me wonder. I mean, people send their kids to elite private schools for a reason. And, you know, with Elise Stefanik, to, as far as we know from any source who's ever probed this, you know, she's a brilliant person. I guess there's a different story to tell about, you know, her own success as somebody who was able to go into these spaces and get a Harvard education and get elected to Congress as, at the time, the youngest woman ever to do so. That's not the story she's telling, but that is a compelling story if one wants to tell it.
Yeah. And I mean, from the Trump campaign's point of view, especially when, you know, they know that the group Trump has struggled the most with over the span between the 2018 midterms, 2020, and now is suburban college educated women. And, you know, the way you lay out the bio right there, I mean, that could be the, you know, maybe not the appeal the Trump campaign is looking for, but definitely a very strong one in contention for the kind of profile they want in a vice presidential candidate. I think also that she's just a very strategic thinker, and there's nothing that she does without a reason, you know? I think the question is going to be, as the vice presidential speculation heats up and, you know, wherever she might get tapped for a second Trump administration, you know, some of these little adjustments she's made to the bio over the years, you know, made sense at the time and made sense in the, you know, local news ecosystem, but they might come to a head with how she might want to present herself if she does get that pick. And I think that'll be a really interesting thing to follow.
Well, the one thing I will just add here is that Congresswoman Stefanik has a standing invitation to make up that canceled 2017 WAMC Congressional Corner appearance. We're happy to do it whenever. And in the meantime, Jake, thank you so much for your reporting, and thanks for spending all this time with us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Okay, that does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Ian Pickus.